Good morning.
Good morning.
I see a few of you have programs. Are there more programs out there in the porch? Because what I'm going to talk from today would help if you have the program, the blue program. And so a few of you have that. Even if one out of every two or three of you have it. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about right thought or correct attitude, which is the second step in the Eightfold Path. I'm going to start out with a quote from the Dhammapada. All that we are is made up of our thoughts. It is based on our thoughts. If you act with a wise thought, happiness follows you as a shadow. Death never leaves you. And if you act with an unwise thought, unhappiness also follows you as a shadow that never leads you. So that's the second step, and I would say that it's the most pivotal step in the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is written on your program. I think it is. It should be. I think it's the most pivotal, although Zen people generally say the most pivotal are the meditation components, which are the last three, which are effort, mindfulness, and concentration, meditation. But I'm taking issue with that this morning, just for fun. Why not? Saying that really right thought is right attitude is the most important one. And of course, right attitude or right thought emanates from the first one, which is right understanding, correct understanding. So we have the understanding. We listen to a teacher. We read a book on Zen. We read 30 books on Zen. We have an understanding that our skin joins us to all life rather than just divides us. That we're joined to everything at the hip. All life joined at the hip, at the toes, at the head. We have that understanding. That's what Buddhism is all about. That we are never alone. That we have everything with us always. And the second part of the right understanding is that our radio program here that tells us that we're separate and we gotta be careful and it's dangerous out there is a fiction. It's a necessary fiction. It's a Darwinian fiction. Darwin knew why it was necessary, but it's still just a fiction. So that's the understanding then that propels us to have the to have right thought, to have correct attitude. Correct attitude. And Leo Hansen did a wonderful job this morning of setting the stage for this discussion of correct attitude. The shakuhachi instrument, bamboo flute instrument, coming from ancient Zen monasteries to us today.
That piece I played was about 1,300 years old, so I suppose we were the first pieces ever composed for that music.
Uh-huh. I see. 1,300 years. Wow. There are three aspects to correct attitude, to right attitude in traditional Buddhist thought. The first is openness. Noticing those shoulds that close us down, right? I should be calm. I've been sitting here for 40 minutes. I should be calm. I listened to Leo's music. Wow. Why am I off someplace else? I should be calm. I shouldn't be angry at him. He did his best. Oh, sorry, Marty. Maybe I'll choose Monica. I shouldn't be mad. I shouldn't be mad at her. I should never get mad at her. I shouldn't have a busy mind. I shouldn't. We close down. Our thoughts close down. That's not correct attitude. That's not correct attitude. That's attitude that isolates us from the world. Isolates it from our own being. And so we need to notice that. we say, I say, I want a radio program with no ads. I want NPR in here instead of advertisement after advertisement. What do I get? Ad after ad after ad. Over and over again, the same jingles. And they're not even jingles, because they don't jingle, right? They grate. If only I could get rid of those ads. They've closed down. I'm going to get rid of the ads. But I'm sorry. You will never get rid of those ads, I don't think. You might. Good luck. Good luck. You close down. We close down. And you know, I've been doing this practice for a long time. I have to tell you, you can't change your personality by doing this practice any more than you can change the lines in your hands, the lines in your face, and the contour of your nose. You can't. You can't. Your personality is your personality. You're given certain things. Some of you have a busy mind. More naturally. Some of you have a calm mind more naturally. Some of you are angry, get disposed to being angry more naturally. Some of you are disposed to just kind of be more patient more naturally. So we need to work with that and not just close down with our thinking. Because when we close down with our thinking, we're missing out on life. We're missing out on encountering what is. So, open attitude is a process of discovering. Not trying to change it, but discovering. And seeing clearly what it is. What it is that we're shooting about now. What are we shooting about now? Okay. There it is. There it is. Seeing it clearly. And then realizing that it's not always so. That any thought we have is not always so. This is what the book I'm going to be using in spring practice period, in my teacher's book, Suzuki Roshi's book, Not Always So. Not Always So. So when I was with my first teacher at the Zen monastery in California, one day, on 4 and 9 days, we didn't have to work and sit all day. They were free days. We still got up at 5 and did our meditation, but then we had hours free to do our laundry or hike or stuff like that. And then came back and meditated. So this was like maybe a 4 day. And I was having a 1-to-1 with Suzuki Roshi at the beginning of the day. And I said, and this was when I've talked about this before, he had just introduced the Orioki, the nested eating bowls. And we all had to wear robes, even though we were lay people. He had us all wearing robes. Although I don't know if it was him. Somebody, I don't know. Somebody had us all doing that stuff. And I found it very difficult. And I couldn't keep my robes straight. They were all wrinkly. I sat them on the wrong way. I just wanted my jeans back. And then there was the nested eating bowls, which I had a huge difficulty with, huge difficulty. And so I was in talking to him, and I said, nya, 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 you know, you know, right? And he said, well, you're perfect as you are. You're perfect as you are. And I thought, whew, whew. And then I went off and hiked for the day. It's a beautiful area for hiking, Tassajara. Beautiful area. Went off to hike for a day with my friends. Forgot everything. I'm perfect as I am. I'm perfect as I am, right? And I came back at the end of the day and went to my little cabin, which was just next to his cabin, fortunately or unfortunately. I passed by his cabin, and he motioned me like this. You know? Sensei, we used to call him Sensei. I had a wonderful hike. You should go hiking too. And he said, yes, I should go hiking too. I will go hiking. he said, but you know, you could use a little improvement at taking care of your things. And so Suzuki Roshi became known for, you're perfect as you are, and you could use a little improvement. Both. Can you entertain both those? Can you entertain them? Can you accept both those? Can you just be with them? You're perfect as you are. And you could use a little improvement. But if you just go with one, if you just go with a little improvement one, you're beating yourself up, you're beating your spouse up, you're beating whomever up. And if you just go with, oh, things are perfect as they are, you're probably flaking out on your commitment to be with people, to support them, to be with your own practice, to support it. So open, open. That's the first part of right thinking, open attitude. The second part is renunciation. Renunciation. So if you want to establish a meditation practice, if you do establish a meditation practice, it takes some renunciation. You have to renunciate some stuff. Maybe you just have to renunciate staying up late and watching TV. But that might be a pretty big renunciation. For some of us, it is. For some of us, it is. Not for me, sometimes. I don't know, sometimes. Or you may have to renounce something else. You may have to renounce... what else do you have to renounce? Eating the wrong food before you go to bed. Or eating, if you're going to sit at night, eating too big a dinner before you sit. So you have to renounce. It's about renunciation. And we need to... We need to renounce to do this practice. It's not very American to renounce. Not very American. Americans, we consume. It's a consumer culture. I have an agency. We help people. We call them all consumers. It's all about consuming, right? And we have so much to consume. And I was talking last time, we have freedom of choice. And in a way, it's a curse. We have the curse of choice. It's wonderful freedom, but consume, curse. So renunciation is a little hard for us as Americans. And I'm not saying it's not hard in other cultures, I don't know. Never lived in another culture. There's a Sufi saying, when a pickpocket meets a saint, he only sees the saint's pockets. You heard that before? When a pickpocket meets a saint, he only sees the saint's pockets. Well, that's because what we want determines what we see. What we want determines what we see. So we need to do a little bit of renunciation around that. Or we'll just be closed in. We need to open that attitude a little bit. My wife has been gone for 2 weeks. She just got back last night. She's retired, and I work all the time. Poor boy. I work all the time. Or you could say I play all the time, but I don't know. So she cooks like many, many years ago in the old days. She cooks because I get home after a long day, both doing zazen, doing Zen stuff, doing my nonprofit stuff, and always a nice meal. But she's been gone for 2 weeks, so nobody's there. So the minute I leave the office, all I notice on the way home is restaurants. I don't see anything but restaurants. And I think, whoa, a home-cooked meal? No. A home-cooked meal? No. The wedge? Where would I sit? No. I don't see the barber shops. I don't see the stores. I don't see the street. I just see restaurants. Do you know this experience a little bit? You know it a lot. You know it a lot. So we're going to have coffee hour after this, right? Tea hour, if you don't drink coffee. Tea hour. So, who will you approach? Maybe you want to make a friend. Then you'll just look at the friendly people who look friendly. Everybody else will tune out, but you're kind of lonely. You've come here because maybe you want to make a friend. And she looks kind of friendly. And you'll ignore everybody else. And you'll just go to her. And you'll spend all your time with her. Oh, I can make a friend. Isn't that nice? You forget everything else. Well, maybe you've come here because you want to look for a romantic partner. Oh, then that's all you'll do. You'll be checking it. You'll be checking the people out. Looking at their ring finger, right? That's all. Or maybe, Jack Kornfield says, if you're a barber, you'll be looking at their hair. You'll be saying, oh, forget him. How about this guy? How about this guy? Right? So this practice of renunciation is putting aside for a little bit, just a little bit, what we want. Just putting it aside. Noticing that we're a little bit spoiled that way. We're a little bit spoiled. And that if we put aside, we can develop some strength of heart. And we can develop a kind of a sense of well-being that isn't contingent on getting our needs met. You think it's possible to have a sense of well-being that isn't contingent on getting every need met? It is. It's possible. But it takes a little restraint. It takes a little renunciation. It actually takes a lot. But just do a little for now. Just do a little for now. That's Zen training. People always say, what's Zen training about? What are you training to be? Well, you're training to be free from your habitual way of being in the world, from being enslaved by those habits and those desires. That's what you're training to be, so that you can have a little lightness in your life, a little lightness, a little joy, a little spontaneity. So Jack Kornfield suggests taking something, whatever, taking a habit, taking an I want or a habit, and looking at it, looking at it. Like, let's say, craving for sweets, or thinking about sweets, or wanting to eat sweets. Something which I actually notice more when my wife's gone. Isn't that interesting? I do. Notice it more. Comes up more often. What could be going on there? So he suggests looking at it. He suggests, and then taking a day when you just say, I'm just going to look at this, and I'm actually going to count the number of times that I'm craving sweets, that I'm thinking about sweets, that I'm going for sweets. I'm going to count. And the only reason for that is to develop the mindfulness, to develop the mindfulness. And he suggests doing that for a week and just seeing what happens. And you begin to see as you do that that it all comes and goes. Those clouds in the sky, that sweet-eating cloud, goes away, comes back, goes away. Sky's still there. Sky's always there. You begin to see that. You begin to develop a little bit of openness. A little bit of, oh, okay, there it is. And then, Jack Kornfield recommends in the second week, you practice renunciation. But he says, don't make too big a deal out of it. Just notice what happens when you don't go get into that thought. You see the thought comes up. Oh, I want a sweet. How can I get a sweet? You watch it. You don't entertain it anymore. You don't indulge it. If you notice yourself going toward the sweet counter, you pay attention and you restrain yourself. And you see what happens. So that's pretty good. That's a pretty good use of Buddhist teaching, I think. Pretty good use. And you develop inner strength from that. It just happens. You develop it. And many of you remember Ram Dass years ago. I wonder if Ram Dass is still alive. I don't know. Is he still alive? Oh. Is he doing okay? No, he's not doing okay. He calls this being a connoisseur of your neurosis. We become and it sounds a little flippant, but he's trying to lighten it up a little bit by saying, yes, you can become a connoisseur of your neurosis. You can become so familiar with it, you see, oh, here it comes again. You can chuckle. You can weep if you want, but after a while, you can only weep so much, you might as well chuckle. And you develop some freedom, not just to follow your habit, but to be completely present with what is. And the third quality of non-harming, the second step on the path, right attitude, is non-harming or loving thoughts. So openness, renunciation, and loving thoughts. And that's a practice too, of course. St. Francis de Sales says, a cup of knowledge, a barrel of love, and an ocean of patience. So you know, for this path, you don't need much knowledge. You don't need much knowledge. You've got plenty of knowledge. Yeah, sure, we study all these things. We study them so that they can help us develop a barrel of love and an ocean of patience. That's why we do it. We don't study them to get smart or to one up each other. I mean, you can do that, but why bother? Go out in the world and make some money doing it instead of doing it here. That's why we do it. So you don't need much knowledge, but we need a barrel of love. And for a barrel of love, it takes huge patience. Because it's not just doing a little metta, a little loving-kindness meditation. I'll come in here, I'll do 5 minutes of loving-kindness meditation, and at 2 o'clock tomorrow, I'll do another 5 minutes every day. That's cool. But this takes a lot of patience, this loving-kindness practice. Because it's your whole life. It's your whole life. And it's about cultivating this attitude. So my father died a year and a half ago. During the last, I don't know, maybe 3-4 years of his life, I had to really work on thoughts of love. Because he was not responsive to me. He turned his back to me. Of course, he was totally out of it. But... not his fault, but he wasn't there. The father that I knew was not there. So I wasn't naturally generous. I was naturally pissed. Well, I was pissed. Where'd you go? Come back. So I had to work on it. We have to work on these things. That's what Zen practice is all about. But we work lightly. Not all, I should, but lightly. Well, so now my father's been dead for a year and a half, and now my cat, my 17-year-old cat, is misbehaving. My own personal cat whom I love so much. When my children left home, I got 2 cats to replace my children. My wife and I got 2 cats. They were just tiny, homeless cats, little kittens. Now she is 17 years old, and while my wife was gone for the last 2 weeks, she peed all over everything. She peed on the oriental rugs. She peed on the bath mat. I put my pajamas down just once. She peed on them. And Linda said, well, you should have known not to put them down. Woo. Strict, huh? What am I? Sometimes I feel like just throwing her outside. Just throwing her outside. Huh. I have to come back to loving kindness. I have to come back to my skin connects me to her. Her fur connects her to me, to everything, to all life. Time and time again. Time and time again, I have to come back. I don't have to. I want to. I want to. Because that's the understanding that Buddha passed on to us, that we're all in this together. We're all in this together. And this right attitude, this right thinking, has nothing to do with instant gratification. You can't come here just once or twice or three times or four times or 100 times and have it all change. That's not what it's about. It's about commitment your whole life. And it's about eventually developing some freedom from being on automatic pilot. Some freedom from that. Trungpa Rinpoche says, "Frankly, I recommend that you don't start the spiritual path because it's painful and difficult." Ooh. Those of you who are here for the first time on Sundays, I apologize deeply. Deeply. Not too deeply. "Frankly, I recommend that you don't start the spiritual path because it's painful and it's difficult. So my recommendation to all of you is not to do it. You can leave now." "Then," he said, "then," right? "Then," he said, "but I have a second recommendation. And that is, if you start, you better finish. If you begin, really do it. Really do it." And I would correct him by saying, "You're never going to finish. Just really do it. When you finish, you close down. I've got it. I'm the guy. I'm the man. Can't you guys see I'm the man?" Close down. Close down. No practice left. Dead. Lost our life. Lost our joy of living, which is so close to us, so close in our heart of hearts, waiting to be recognized. So we have this capacity. We have this capacity to practice right attitude. Open, renounce, and love. Open, restrain, and love. And we can work with it in our kitchen, with our 17-year-old cat, with our partner, with our loneliness, with our pain in the leg. We have that potential. And that's pretty wonderful, I think. Pretty wonderful. So the reason I think right thought or right attitude is the pivotal one is that the others, if the others aren't working, then it's not working because they're not working. It's they're not working because your attitude's got messed up. So speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, meditation, we have to come back to that pivotal one. So give a couple of examples before I close. Okay, so say speech, right speech. Most of us know what right speech is. We don't have to be a rocket scientist to know what kind of speech is compassionate and honest and straightforward. But often we don't do it. And in small communities, whether they be places of work or places of worship or even neighborhoods, one of the things that we do instead of right speech is we triangulate, right? Okay. Most people know that. It's become sort of a common word in our vocabulary. We triangulate. I have an issue with you, and I think he might have an issue with you too. So I'm going to hang out with Matt, and we're going to talk about how pissed we are at you. Because I could tell that Matt is sympathetic. That you're grating on him too. So Matt and I are going to develop an alliance. And our alliance is going to be about you, honey. Excuse me. We triangulate. That ain't right speech, right? That ain't right speech. It divides. It conquers. But it conquers in a way in which there's always someone out and other people in. Someone who is in, who is out. So if we're not doing that right speech, if we're not doing that, it's probably because of our thinking. It's probably because of our attitude. We have to come back. What's going on here? What are my thoughts about you? What are my shoulds about you? You should be, I don't know, you should be coming more often. You should be doing more work around here. I know you have those kids, but geez, forget them. You know, so I need to open to my shoulds. Open to my shoulds, right? And then I need to do a little renunciation of talking to Matt because I need to renounce that. I may not be ready to talk with you yet because, you know, I'm just not sure how you're going to take it. I don't know if I'm going to do it well, but at least I can renounce talking to Matt. And then a little loving kindness. A little loving kindness toward myself for getting in this mess and to you for caring more about your kids than you do about Zen Center. What a bizarre notion. And some loving kindness to you to getting sucked in by me. So being so vulnerable. So working with the thinking. But sometimes you can't work with the thinking. Sometimes the thinking doesn't, you don't want to work. You want to bypass. You think, oh, God, I know all this technique-y stuff. I don't want to do that. I don't like him. I mean, just period. I just don't like him. So I don't have to like him, do I? So you continue your grumbling. Then you come back to the first step on the Eightfold Path. Understanding. What is the understanding? The understanding is that you and I are connected at our heart level, even if we don't know each other. Because all life is connected at this heart level. And that's why, when I was young, I used to hear go to Suzuki Roshi's talks twice a week. And at Tassajara, he talked every day. Why do you think? Not because he wanted to impart knowledge to us. He didn't want to impart knowledge to us because he wanted to remind us. We need to be reminded of this teaching over and over again because we get off so quickly. So everybody said, oh, this isn't really Zen with Suzuki Roshi talking an hour a day. I mean, that's what they said, the Rinzai people all marched around us. He talks sometimes in the morning, sometimes at noon, sometimes at night, every day. Well, he's got these bunch of people together in these monasteries. These are all, what are they, post-beatnik, pre-hippie, dippy people, you know, we're all in our early 20s, and he sees, well, we're triangulating, we're rectangulating, we're coangulating, you know. So he's just reminding us, of interconnectedness. He's reminding us that we don't have to be mesmerized by this radio program. And the ads, we don't have to be hypnotized moment after moment by it. So that's the first one. So sometimes we just have to come back to the first one. Understanding. So last example. So meditation. What if your meditation's not going well? Maybe you're not really doing it. Not going well because you're not doing it. Okay. Then you come back to your thinking, your attitude. Well, you try to be open. You try to notice what should is getting in the way of your sitting. Maybe you're not sitting because you think you should be making progress. And since you couldn't make progress, you thought you'd do Tai Chi instead, because at least with Tai Chi, you can feel fluid and whatever, right? But with sitting in a stupid wall, you don't even get any relief in your body. So everybody should do Qigong and Tai Chi instead. I mean, I'm not. There's a wonderful practice. I'm just giving this as an example, right? So you're open to that. You're open to your shooting, and then you notice how you could possibly restrain yourself a little bit. What you could renunciate to just sit for 5 minutes before you go to bed. What you would have to renunciate to do that. And then a little loving kindness about giving yourself a break. That even if you just sit for 1 minute every 3 days, that's 1 minute of quiet. As I said in my last talk, geez, the people that I used to hang out with in Mexico, and I didn't even know them when I was a kid, the Mexicans, they would just stand in the water. They didn't know it was meditation. For them, it wasn't meditation. But they just stood in the water, down by the ocean. Stand in the water for 10 minutes a day, doing nothing. Whereas we Americans, we'd be water skiing around them, we'd be surfing around them, we'd be getting our tans and comparing our tans. We'd just be standing there in the water. So this meditation's not that complicated, you guys. It's not that complicated. And then, if it doesn't work, if the thinking doesn't work in regard to your meditation, come back to the basic understanding. The understanding is that by sitting quietly, doing nothing, nothing at all, you can begin to let go of those habits that close you in, that make you feel separate from something that you're really joined to. So I think I want to just close by reading this again. All that we are is made up of our thoughts. It is based on our thoughts. If you act with a wise thought, happiness follows you as a shadow that never leaves you. And if you act with an unwise thought, unhappiness follows you as a shadow that never leaves you. So I'll entertain questions or comments or whatever. Who has a question or a comment or a reflection?
How do you decide how much is enough?
How much is enough? Meditation?
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide how much meditation is enough? Oh. Well, in the first place, I think in your day, begin to notice that you have a lot of opportunities for meditation. That meditation doesn't have to be what you think it is. That you have a lot of opportunities just for doing the kind of standing in the water meditation that these Mexican people used to do when I was a kid. In rush hour, I have a lot of. When I'm on the freeway coming back from St. Paul, 15 years ago, I could get home from St. Paul in 20 minutes at rush hour. Now it takes me 45 minutes to get home. I have a lot of opportunity for meditation. I don't mean meditation formally. I just mean for practicing being here, being with my breathing, being with the slowness of the car going. Sometimes it even stops. Instead of getting pissed, here's an opportunity to meditate. But not to meditate as something out there, just to be with the sounds of the cars, with my own breathing, with even my own frustration if I'm trying to get someplace. As a therapist, when I used to be a therapist, my break between clients, just going and washing my hands, meditating. By not trying to meditate, just washing. So I think the first thing to do is notice that you have lots of opportunities. Lots and lots of opportunities. But then try to consciously say to yourself, these are my opportunities. Then you don't have to guilt yourself for not doing it. not creating a special environment to do it in, because wherever you are, there's almost, in some cases not. You know, if you have to be in a lot of dialogue with someone and there's tension, but even then, you can active listen. If you active listen, it's the beginning of it. It's almost meditation, almost, if you really do it. So I would say that's the most important thing. The most important thing. Then you don't have to develop another should. And that said, I also believe that sitting quietly doing absolutely nothing sometimes is important. And how much of the time? I think you should spend 10 minutes a day sitting quiet, minimally, sitting quietly doing absolutely nothing. No TV, no eating. And whether you're sitting like this, or whether you're sitting like this, or whether you're sitting, even lying down, I don't think it matters. But if you're lying down, don't be too comfy. I mean, be aware. Be aware. So I think that's the most important thing. What do you think?
Well, it's very helpful, actually. Just when you talk about catching the moments, I think you've probably got me another couple hours every day already.
Oh, wow.
Great.
Okay. Yeah.
I was going to say, this is really profound, like simply profound to be here today. Just been looking for a lot of that quiet in my busy life. And you were talking about, you know, where you find this. And my fiance and I were in Barnes & Noble and looking at Thich Nhat Hanh's books. And there's that story that just totally stands out. He's eating tangerines with his friend. And his friend is, and that's how I eat, you know, Don was going to Barnes & Noble. It's all gone. And my fiance is like, slow down, man. Did you enjoy that? I'm like, yes. And Thich Nhat Hanh just, you know, basically said the same thing. Just slow down instead of, you know, eating the whole thing like this. Just eat each tangerine as it goes in and enjoy that. And then his friend ended up going to prison. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a letter to him, and his friend was in there for protesting violence. And Thich Nhat Hanh basically just said, you know, if you're sitting there with the four walls around you, remember the tangerine. And so here I am reading that with Carrie and really thinking about this, and then coming here today and hearing your words, and it's just very powerful. So I wanted to share that story, but also to thank you for the gift you are and the gift of being here today.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah. You'll have to speak a little louder.
Who was it again who says a cup of knowledge, a barrel of love, and an ocean of patience?
Yeah.
Who was it?
Oh, who was it who said that? Let's see, who was it who said that? Oh, Francis de Sales. Yes, St. Francis de Sales from the Catholic Church. An ocean of patience, he said. Yep. Catholic mystics are cool, you guys, if you're not onto them. They're cool. Really. Really. Teresa de Avila, Meister Eckhart, St. John of the Cross. Anything else?
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
I find that it is much easier for me to experience the moments of my life mindfully when I have a consistent daily sitting meditation practice. It's easier for me.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. An endorsement. What?
Unpaid.
Oh, NPR, huh? Yeah.
What do you think about when you're meditating?
What do I think about when I meditate? Nothing. my thoughts come in, they go out. They come in, they go out, they come in, they stay sometimes, they circle around, they do a few somersaults, they leave. Nothing.
Do you recommend a chant?
Oh, you're asking what I recommend you focus on when you sit. Well, I recommend you do whatever is necessary to bring yourself back to just being focused with this. If you have a chant that's not too elaborate, that is grounding, that's meaningful to you, by all means. If you want to work with your breathing, by all means. If you want to put your mind in your hara, this is the Japanese word for your lower abdomen, by all means. Right? Who cares? Who cares? I mean, really, this is about opening up and emptying. And it's not about which technique is the real technique, right? I mean, I don't think it is. Because those techniques, we get caught on them, we close down. But if the chanting works, if just saying something simple over and over again, then do it. And if it doesn't work, do it anyway for a while. Because you shouldn't get too focused on trying to find the right one. Because you'll never find the right one. Just be open.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah.
There is a beginner's mind class for people who are beginning practice and have questions. And I believe it's every other Tuesday night, but somebody has the information.
That's right. It's every other Tuesday night here, and it's free. More NPR stuff. Yeah.
Going back to the
How
do you know if the thought that you're acting on is wise?
You don't know. You don't know. The Dhammapada is oversimplifying.
Jim, could you repeat that question to the...
Oh, yeah. She says, how do you know if the thought that you have is wise? You don't know. You don't know. But you do know something about its valence, something about where it's taking you. Is it taking you toward feeling a little paranoid or feeling cut off? Or is it taking you toward being accepting, feeling connected, feeling kind? You know that. You know that. Now, sometimes you don't even know that. Then I think if you don't know that, come back to the first step on the path. Come back and read some literature that remind yourself of it, or listen to a teacher, so that you can get grounded on the first step. The first step is the last step. This is about right understanding and then emanating wisdom from that understanding. How's that? Oh, that's good. Thank you. Yeah.
Can you say something about the word right?
Yeah, sure. The word right, I don't like the word right. And my early translations, I mean, when I didn't know Sanskrit very well, I still don't know it very well, but I know a little better, I deleted the word right and put complete in. But then I went back and learned some more Sanskrit, and I saw that it really is right or correct. Now, I prefer... The reason I don't like right is that then we get into this right-wrong kind of thing, this right-wrong duality. So correct attitude may be better than right attitude. Correct means just it's correct in that you feel connected to everything because of that attitude. You feel like you're part of all of life and you're contributing, and it's contributing to you. And it's the dance of life. And incorrect thought, incorrect attitude is you feel like you've got to fight with it. It's the only way to get along. It's just to fight. So I wish Buddha had said it differently. But you understand what I'm talking about? We always wish somebody said it differently, right? And that's the way it is. And there is some point in calling it correct, because there is a correct and incorrect. As long as we don't get into this rigid thinking where we close ourselves off, I mean, we're saying, oh, I'm being open now. That's the first component of right thought. I'm being open, 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 open. Oh, I've got to share this with Marty, then I'm going to share this with you, then I'm going to share this with her. Well, come on, I'm taking open a little too far, right? Okay, thank you.